This episode was recorded on the country of the Gadabinund people, which includes the rainforest plateau and rugged coastline of Cape Otway in Victoria. I pay my respects to elders past and present, and to the other elders of the Gundijimara Nation. I would also like to pay my respect to the elders of the Yuin Nation. Welcome to Weekend Birder. I'm Kirsty Costa. I hope that life is treating you well, listener friend. I'm loving hearing from you all. Sounds like the last episode on feathers really captured your imagination. In this episode, we are joined by Jack Pascoe. Jack is a proud Yuin man whose mob is from southern New South Wales. He was one of those kids who loved birdwatching at a young age.
As a young fella, my family decided to go on a round Australia trip, and I think I should have been in grade four. As opposed to being in grade four, we went around Australia. And at that stage, I was fascinated by birds enough that my two Slater books, you know, the Passerines and non-Passerines books, I knew back to front and side out. At that point in my life, I could pretty well know every bird as we went around Australia on sight. Wasn't an amazing with the calls and still am not. But it was an obsession of mine, and so we went from campsite to campsite. Mum and Dad would farm me out to people who wanted to learn the birds in the area, in the different caravans and tents, in exchange for them teaching me my grade four curriculum. So they in particular wanted me to learn to play the recorder, so people with any musical talents that were in the campsites or in would try and help me learn that beast of an instrument. That's what I recall about being interested in birds was that first trip around Australia. But I grew up and I still live on Gadabinund country, southwest Victoria. Gadabinund is one of the five language groups that make up the Gundijimara Nation. We live in the middle of the scrub on Cape Otway. So we're surrounded by country, but by nature and birds all of my childhood. In terms of being interested in ecology, I don't think I'd really considered it as a young person. But I did know that I desperately wanted to get out of the little township of Apollo Bay and go and do something else. I think I was ready to be exposed to different experiences when I was at the end of my schooling. And the Year 10 careers teacher suggested that I should go and do a conservation ecology course at Deakin University. And because I hadn't had any particularly good ideas otherwise, I agreed with her and went and did that. So my interest in ecology started there, I guess.
Jack completed his studies and became an ecologist. An ecologist is someone who studies the relationship between living organisms and their physical environment. They seek to understand the connections between plants and animals and the world around them. Jack has led conservation programs in the Otways for over 10 years. He now works with the University of Melbourne and is also a chief counsellor at the Biodiversity Council. His research started in the middle of a forest at midnight.
When I got through my undergraduate and did my honours, I was looking at forest owls or nocturnal birds really in the Otway Ranges and their association with different habitats and prey species, so lots of arboreal stuff. And I got to spend a year studying these animals, doing call playback, so playing the calls to elicit a territorial response from them in order to detect presence. It really was a presence-absence study. It was an interesting year of my life. I was also running a kitchen in Kew in order to pay my way through university. So I think I used to work mornings of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then I would skill off at lunchtime Wednesday, drive back to the Otways and camp for four nights and do outrageous hours at night and then sleep through the day, wake up in time to catch a crayfish, have it for dinner and then go back out doing surveys. It was a good lifestyle. It was pretty hectic. It was good fun, but I'll never forget those nights. This is before universities really cared whether you had anyone with you when you did your field surveys. So I'd just be sitting on the bonnet of the car next to my massive megaphone that was playing powerful owl or masked owl calls, sipping on my black coffee in the middle of absolutely nowhere, wondering if it was a sane thing to do. And then occasionally you'd have a masked owl or a powerful owl stalk you while you were doing a spotlight survey for arboreal mammals because you'd upset them. That will always stick with me as a memorable scene, as with any animals that you're interacting with. You have so many memorable moments. We're really lucky now to live on a 40-acre property in the foothills of the Otways that as I'm doing birding and various things on the property, getting followed by little birds who think you're good company because you provide them with opportunities to pick up bugs out of the scrub.
Jack says that although he was a keen bird watcher as a kid, this didn't translate into an obsession with birds as an adult. but he has chosen to surround himself with birds on the 40 acres that he is caring for in the Otways.
My studies after my honours sort of moved a little way away from birds and more into studying predatory animals and their interactions with prey, which did include a little bit of stuff with large forest owls. But I think other than, you know, experiences through the extraordinarily large amount of field work I've done in the course of my life, probably the nicest place to watch birds for me now is on the deck of our house. And as I mentioned, we live on this 40-acre property now, and I tell my wife we bought it because it was a nice house that was in the bush, but just close enough to town that she didn't feel too isolated. But in reality, we bought it because it was flat country in the Otways, but it had these extraordinary old madigums that I don't know how old they are, but I suspect they probably predate colonisation, and they're rare as hen's teeth. These old madigums that are just full of tree hollows. So they're probably in the last phase of their lives, but they probably outlive us regardless, or outlive me regardless. The bird life that we see on the property because of those madigums is unlike anything else in the region really that I've come across. So we're incredibly lucky to be able to sit on the deck when we do get a gap in the sideways rain in the Otways and be able to see things really from that place. We have two unnatural dams on the property, but they also bring in a whole stack of birds that we wouldn't see otherwise as well. And because of those dams, we have, you know, wood ducks come in and out each year to breed, and ducklings jump out precariously out of these holes to get into the dam. And it is a magnificent place that we're very, very privileged and always very grateful to observe the bird life that we get there on a property. And we just have a huge diversity of animals on the property. Very lucky.
One of the things that I love about hosting this podcast is listening to guests talk about their local birds and how things change throughout the seasons. That's what Jack is going to do for us now, focusing on the birds on his property.
There are a couple of significant birds to us. Our daughter, when she was born, kookaburras started to hang out around our house in Apollo Bay in quite remarkable numbers. And then she turned into one of those kids that always wakes up at the, you know, when the sun rises, and that's exactly what she's become. And so I'm a Ewan fella. Now old people used to wait for the kookaburra to call for the third time to know it was time to get up and greet grandfather sun every morning. So Lily has been very good at helping us to get up and perform that ancient ceremony every day. So she has become the Guganiella for us. And we're lucky to have a number of kookaburra families or Guganiella families on the property. In terms of things happening seasonally, I mentioned the wood ducks. They're always with us, but they're at different stages at different times of the year. And obviously they're just sort of starting to come out of their nests now in these big old madigums. I guess probably the most significant thing is, and I think in the Otways and probably similar places like Tasmania, everyone's pretty keen for winter to break. And so you're kind of waiting, and you get a few of these sort of false sunny days in August, which is, you can't let your hopes get up. You know, winter hasn't broken yet. And for me, it's the fantail cuckoos. When they start calling everywhere, and you can practically hear them for 6 months of the year calling everywhere throughout our forest. And once they start calling, you know you're probably in for some better weather, although it's going to come with a bit of wind. That's sort of what we listen for. The robins change throughout the seasons, which robins are here and what we have. Golden whistlers come in and off the property at different times as well. I guess you really notice those really vocal birds echoing across the place. There's obviously animals that live here all the time that don't move particularly far, but you certainly notice those seasonal changes when you're in amongst it.
Jack just mentioned the fantail cuckoo, and we heard a recording from Mark Anderson. This species of cuckoo is found in eastern Australia, western Australia, and Tasmania. Birds in Tasmania migrate to the mainland in winter. This bird also lives in New Caledonia, New Guinea, Fiji, and New Zealand. If you've never seen one before, the fantail cuckoo is about 28 centimetres long, which is a bit smaller than a rainbow lorikeet. You'll often hear it before you see it. If you get a glimpse, it's easily identifiable by its barred black and white feathers in the underpart of its tail. It looks similar to the brush cuckoo, but it's larger and it has a yellow eye ring. The brush cuckoo has a grey eye ring. If you'd like to find out more about cuckoos, including their unusual breeding habits, listen to episode 44 with Cassandra and Claire. As a Ewan man and as an ecologist, Jack's understanding of birds is a combination of traditional knowledge that has been passed down to him about country and his science training.
Birds tell you a lot about country. And I've given you one example. The bush around us has such a wide range of forest and woodland species because of these big old trees. I probably bang on about this too much, but the protection of big old trees with tree hollows is so important, and we don't talk about it enough and we don't take it seriously enough. If you have big old trees with tree hollows in good numbers, it changes the bush entirely. So birds can tell you that. They're a really vocal and obvious expression of diversity in forests. They can also tell you a little bit about what's happening in the wider landscape. Up on my country, we spend a lot of time on the Brogo River, which is an important songline for human people. And at the end of the drought, you know, we were up there, and I probably never heard the place so deafening with bird call. What that's telling you is that the rest of country away from the river is too dry and these animals are retreating to these pockets. It was comforting but also disconcerting. Comforting that these birds would find refuge from country that was incredibly dry, but also a worry about, you know, what country was and what their habitat looked like in those really dry times. And obviously, we weren't very far off at that stage from pretty significant bushfires, which had a huge impact on Ewan country, but also a lot of country on the eastern seaboard. So I think birds can tell us a lot about country and its condition. We know when seasons change because certain things are calling and certain behaviours change, but it also tells us of the conditions and where country is happy and where it isn't. I feel like I'm not old enough to say things like this, but in my lifetime, I've seen the number of birds that we see around country really change. And I particularly notice it in wetlands where, you know, even small wetlands used to just be full of swamp hens and spoonbills, and now you see them, but you don't see them in the same numbers. We don't explicitly know the reasons for those things, but it's, you know, cumulative impacts that we aren't accounting for that we need to. We're going to be in a position to hand on to future generations something like what we've had the privilege to see all of our lives, and it's beholden on us to think about it constantly and take it as a responsibility to pass something on to generations that's worth passing on.
One of my favourite questions to ask weekend birder guests is, what gives you hope? It's not just for their sake, it's for me as well, in my search for reasons to feel optimistic about the future. And more than that, I think it sets the tone for how we approach birdwatching and our relationship with nature. Celebrating the beauty around us, acknowledging the resilience of nature, that's a position of strength rather than constantly look at what is missing and what needs saving. It turns out that Jack feels the same way.
There's probably two things that give me hope. Young people give me hope because they're awesome. I don't teach a lot, but when I do, the next generation of kids coming through are aware of their responsibilities and they take them really seriously. And I hope they influence their parents because they're magnificent creatures. And I would like to think I was as switched on as that. When I was doing my education, I suspect that I wasn't. The other thing that gives me hope is I think we have an opportunity to move away from this deficit approach of managing the world. You know, we're constantly fixated on the things that we're losing, and I understand why, because we are losing things and we need to be aware of that. But by focusing on those things, we desperately try and save those things as a specific task, and it's like trying to catch grains of sand as they slip through your fingers. We actually need to go back to operating from a position of strength and working with country to build that strength and that resilience. It's a way that the old people used to work with country. You know, they didn't concentrate on the rarest thing or the thing that was represented the least or was having the most trouble. They knew that working with country holistically was the way to do it. That gives me hope because we haven't done it particularly well to date. We don't think about it in that way, but we can. It will have great influence. So if we think about all of the decisions that we make as a society, they can all have input and they can all directly influence things like birds. We can push back so easily in a democratic system if we choose to make it a priority on things like how our food is grown, what chemicals do we accept are used that, you know, have such damaging impact on food charts. We can change those things. And that gives me hope because I really don't think that the humans of our society can and will continue to turn a blind eye to the damage that's done to country. I don't think future generations will accept it. And I think more and more our generation is not accepting of it. So that gives me hope because we need to take our responsibility to country very seriously. And it's another thing that we can take from the old people. Responsibility was the basis of culture, for all Aboriginal culture. It's the responsibility for country and for kin that is dictated by law and passed down from generation to generation. And I think non-Indigenous Australia is waiting for an invitation from some old fella that's going to walk out of the bush and initiate them. But the invitation has always been there from Indigenous people, for non-Indigenous people to be responsible for caring for country. How many mobs, when you talk to them, they'll tell you they're all people. The first thing that they tried to do when non-Indigenous people lobbed in the country was initiate them into the ways of country. With the elders that I speak to across the land, that invitation is still open. And it is a wonderful invitation into something far more valuable than a society that is fixated on perpetual growth and capitalism. It's true value is the connections between ourselves, our relationships with each other, and our relationships to the world. Once we open our third eye and see that that is in fact the things of value, then I think we change the world, and that is giving me great hope.
How about you? What gives you hope for the future? Do you look at birds and their habitats with a deficit mindset or a strength mindset? I hope Jack's words have supported or challenged your thinking a bit about this. Many thanks to Jack for sharing his stories and insights. If you'd like to read more about his work, I've included a link to the University of Melbourne's website in the show notes. In the next episode, we're going to meet an artist who paints pictures of birds on huge grain silos in regional Australia. And we're also going to get to know one of Australia's most iconic birds.